Jayarada Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jayarada Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Prabhupada ki jai, Shishi Kishore Kishore ki, Gantara Shima Bhagavatam ki, Thai Gaur Premanande. Narayanam Namaskrityam Naram Chaivam Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Adhiraye Nashta Prayeshya Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttamashtoke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Hare Krishna. Welcome to morning Srimad Bhagavatam class. Reading from Canto 9. Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 18, text 30 through 32. I'll read text 30 and 31, and then we'll chant 32 together. Text 30. Nahushaya sutam datva sahasa mishta yoshana tam maharajan cham mishtam adastalpe nakarichit. Translation. When Shukracharya gave Devayani in marriage to Yayati, he had Sarmishta go with her, but he warned the king, "My dear king, never allow this girl, Sarmishta, to lie with you in bed." Text 31. Vilokyashanafshin rajan charmishta suprajan krachit Tam eva vavirahasi sakya patim ritosati. O King Parikshit, upon seeing Devayani with a nice son, Sarmishta once approached King Yayati at the appropriate time for conception. In a secluded place, she requested the king, the husband of her friend Devayani, to enable her to have a son also. Text 32. Please repeat. Rajaputyartitopatye Dharmam javiksya dharmavit Smaranchukavachakale Dishtam eva vyapadyata Rajaputyartitopatye Dharmam chaviksya dharmavit Smaranchukatvachakale Dishtam eva vyapadyata Rajaputyartitopatye Dharmam javiksya dharmavat Smaranchukavachakale Dishtam eva vyapadyata. Please chant.
Thank you.
Rajaputya by Sarmishta, who was the daughter of a king. Artita, being requested. Apatye, for a son. Dharmam, religious principles. Cha, as well as. Avakshaya, considering. Dharmavit, aware of all religious principles. Smaran, remembering. Shukravacha, the warning of Shukracharya. Kali, at the time. Dishtam, circumstantially. Eva, indeed. Abhyapadyata, accepted to fulfill the desire of Sarmishta. Translation. When Princess Sarmishta begged King Yayati for a son, the king was certainly aware of the principles of religion, and therefore he agreed to fulfill her desire. Although he remembered the warning of Shukracharya, he thought of this union as the desire of the Supreme, and thus he had sex with Sarmishta. Purport. King Yayati was completely aware of the duty of a Kshatriya. When a Kshatriya is approached by a woman, he cannot deny her. This is a religious principle. Consequently, when Dharmaraj Yudhisthira saw Arjuna unhappy after Arjuna returned from Dvarka, he asked whether Arjuna had refused a woman who had begged for a son. Although Maharaj Yayati remembered Shukracharya's warning, he could not refuse Sarmishta. He thought it wise to give her a son, and thus he had sexual intercourse with her after her menstrual period. This kind of lust is not against religious principles. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 7:11, Dharma viruddha bhuteshu kamosmin. Sex life not contrary to the principles of religion is sanctioned by Krishna. Because Sarmishta, the daughter of a king, had begged Yayati for a son, their combination was not lust, but an act of religion. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvata Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunivadi Pashita Deshitarine Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyebhyascha Patitanam Pavaneb Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. I ask for the blessings of senior Vaishnavas. I can speak on this verse something of value. Don't have much prepared, but we'll see. Hopefully Krishna will use me as an instrument. So this is a interesting verse to speak on. Sarmishta is the maidservant of Devayani, and it's natural for her to also want a child from the king. She was given, along with Devayani and other maidservants, to serve Devayani with the king. And this is common in the royal marriage, as described in the previous purport. It's common to send the maidservants along with the wife when there's a marriage, a royal marriage. But in this verse, these verses is being described, that after Sarmishta saw Devayani with a nice son, she also desired to have a son, which is only natural for a woman to want. She approached King Yayati at the appropriate time. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada describes that the religious duty of a kshatriya is to not deny a woman who has taken shelter of him, if she requests for a son, that they can't deny it. So this puts King Yayati in kind of a tricky situation, where he had the instructions of Sukracharya, very powerful spiritual master, Brahmana, to not do this, but it's also against the religious principles to deny her of her request to beget a son. So we'll hear the reactions that will come to King Yayati because of the upsetting Sukracharya and going against his instruction. But for now, this is the situation, that King Yayati is accepting Sarmishta's request for a child and going against the order of Sukracharya. And so this chapter in the Srimad Bhagavatam is called King Yayati Regains His Youth. So this is the beginning of that turn of events, of a reaction that will come to King Yayati, and then what he does in order to counteract that reaction. I wanted to speak a little bit about this idea of kama, or lust, and also the principle as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 7:11 of sex life that's not against religious principles. So it's stated in the purport of that verse that sex life that's not against religious principles is just the sex life meant for bringing children into the world and raising them to be Krishna conscious. So this is the only purpose for sex life, is to raise Krishna conscious children. When it's not for that purpose, it's described in the Bhagavad Gita that it's the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. This lust, this desire. So I wanted to read a little bit from the purport of that verse in chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita, text 37. That's the verse that I just quoted. It's a verse where the verse previous to that one, Arjuna is asking Krishna, why does it seem like these people are impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly, as if engaged by force? So, and then Krishna answers that it's lust. So, it's lust which is born of contact with the material mode of passion and later transformed into wrath, which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. So, I'm going to read a little bit of the purport and try to kind of go into the detail with this principle of lust to see more in depth this principle. In this purport, we're reading like someone who's acting properly according to religious principles, but I was just going to go and just evaluate the opposite side of lust. So when a living entity comes in contact with the material creation, his eternal love for Krishna is transformed into lust in association with the mode of passion. Or in other words, the sense of love of God becomes transformed into lust, as milk in contact with sour tamarind is transformed into yogurt. Then again, when lust is unsatisfied, it turns into wrath. Wrath is transformed into illusion, and illusion continues the material existence. Therefore, lust is the greatest enemy of the living entity, and it is lust only which induces the pure living entity to remain entangled in the material world. Wrath is the manifestation of the mode of ignorance. These modes exhibit themselves as wrath and other corollaries. If, therefore, the mode of passion, instead of being degraded into the mode of ignorance, is elevated to the mode of goodness by the prescribed method of living and acting, then one can be saved from the degradation of wrath by spiritual attachment. The Supreme Personality of Godhead expanded himself into many for his ever-increasing spiritual bliss, and the living entities are parts and parcels of this spiritual bliss. They also have partial independence, but by misuse of their independence, when the service attitude is transformed into the propensity for sense enjoyment, they come under the sway of lust. This material creation is created by the Lord to give facility to the conditioned souls to fulfill these lustful propensities. And when completely baffled by prolonged lustful activities, the living entities begin to inquire about their real position. So basically, the material world is like a place of lust. It's like the place where the facility given to the souls to come try to enjoy separately from Krishna and exhibit these lustful propensities. So it's completely unnatural for the soul. In the next verse, it's described that this lust, it burns like fire and it's never satisfied. So it's a position of it feeling incomplete, this searching for lust. It's like, because we've turned away from the complete whole, like in the Ishopanishad, it's described that the Supreme Personality of God is perfect and complete. Everything that emanates from it is perfectly complete. Everything is perfect. But when we come under the conditioning of material nature, when we try to, it's a place for us, we've misused our independence, so we feel incomplete, because we've disconnected ourselves from the complete whole, from God, from Krishna. So because we've disconnected consciously, we're not actually disconnected from Krishna. We can't actually ever be away from Krishna or outside of the complete whole. But this material world is a place where we forget our connection with Krishna, and we pursue a life of lust where we try to enjoy separately from the complete whole. We try to become individual controllers or owners of our own realm of enjoyment. So this is what the propensity of lust is. And so it's described that it's never completed. It's never fulfilled. Lust is never fulfilled. It's like chasing. It's like running on a treadmill for something really fast, but it's totally just out of your reach. It seems like you're gonna get it, but it's never there. It never is satisfied. And the example given, the main example given is Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu is the main example of the person who gave it his all to satisfy his lust. He performed austerities for thousands and thousands of years just by standing on his toes, reaching up in the sky, and he was completely beyond this enjoyment at that time. But he was doing it, these austerities. He was beyond the bodily platform, at least it seemed. His body was deteriorated because he was doing austerities, but he was doing it just to satisfy his lust and to get the benediction for Lord Brahma. And because of all these austerities, he became so powerful that the whole universe was under his control. But still, he had so many universes, he had so many wives, control of the heavenly planets, everyone was afraid of him, but still he was completely unhappy. So this is the example given of the perfect materialist who went all the way, as far as you can go, to try to compete with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the completion of lust, is Hiranyakashipu, that he went for it all. And he failed, and he couldn't compete with Krishna, and that's the incarnation of Lord Narasimhadev comes down and takes Hiranyakashipu out with his nails. This is the example of what we can meditate on, not to waste our time pursuing lust, because we can see that even if you become like what appears successful in pursuing lust, it ends in misery. It never ends in happiness. Even if you become the controller of the whole universe, there's still so much dissatisfaction in this pursuit of lust. So the Vedas are given to advance. It's the instruction book to get out of this material conditioning. So there's principles of religion, principles of Dharma that are to be followed, that we can gradually be purified of this lust propensity. And one of them is marriage. Marriage is a principle of Dharma. That is helpful for the conditioned soul. So in this case, Sarmishta is and Yayati are acting according to the principles of religion, Prabhupada says. So this is allowed and this is encouraged in the process of devotional service, spiritual marriage. Srila Prabhupada established pretty much right away. In the very beginning, he started giving marriage to his young disciples. So he encouraged this principle, because it's a gradual process of purification. So in the next verses of the Bhagavad Gita, it's explained how we overcome the enemy of lust. I think it's a few verses down. I'll read it. Some of the two verses. So the working senses are superior to dull matter. The mind is higher than the senses, and intelligence is still higher than the mind. And he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. Thus, knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, one should study the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence, Krishna consciousness, and thus by spiritual strength conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust. So, we have to sharpen our spiritual intelligence by studying the scriptures, studying the Bhagavad Gita, reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. We have to thoroughly understand the situation that we're in. The sword of knowledge that we're given in the Bhagavad Gita is what we cut down this enemy of lust. So we keep sharpening, keep remembering what it is, what is our enemy, because it's described in this also set of verses that the enemy of lust is within us. It's within our mind, it's within our senses, it's within our intelligence. So like even just it's we can't even trust our mind most of the time because the enemy is within our mind. It'll trick us into thinking we should do this, we should do that. We should go here, we should go there. You know, Krishna consciousness is too difficult. I think I'm supposed to actually enjoy. Material enjoyment is actually natural. So I think I should do this. Krishna consciousness has become too difficult. So these thoughts can come. But by strengthening the spiritual intelligence, by observing, by hearing the spiritual knowledge from the Bhagavad Gita, and by hearing from the spiritual master and observing within the world, we hear that this world is a place, material world is a place where we go to employ this lustful propensity, and this lust is never satisfied. So this is a place, it's like a prison, it's like shackles of sex life as described in the purport. So we have to sharpen our intelligence and observe this and apply it into how we see the world. And by the mercy of the spiritual master, following his instructions, we develop spiritual intelligence. And then we have to continue cultivating that spiritual intelligence so we don't fall victim to the enemy of lust. And this is described as a gradual process too. It's something that we have to undergo with a realistic idea of how it takes place as well. That's why marriage is a nice system in Krishna consciousness, because it allows the support for us to practice for our whole lives in a practical way. So we have these propensities, we have these desires, and they can be fulfilled in a Krishna conscious way. If we have a desire to have a family, have children, we have a desire to travel, all these things can be fulfilled within Krishna consciousness. That's the difference between bhakti yoga and other processes of yoga, like just jnana, where you strong renunciation, or mayavadi practices, where they just try to renounce everything as maya. Whereas bhakti provides this higher experience, the higher taste. Devotees can have families and train their children to be Krishna conscious. They can travel to India and travel around, spreading Krishna consciousness, meeting new people, developing nice friendships with devotees. So that's the process. We get to eat nice prasadam that's offered to Krishna. So all these things are ways to gradually purify our senses, because the enemy of lust is within our senses, so it gets disturbed if we neglect it. So that's why nice prasadam is very powerful too. By satisfying the tongue with nice prasadam, we're allowing ourselves to be purified gradually. Whereas if we try to renounce everything and just eat like Raghunath Das Goswami tried to eat just the leftovers, the spoiled food, you know, then our mind becomes so disturbed and our senses become disturbed. But we have such a nice process. We don't have to be like that. We don't need to overeat, but we don't need to, you know, have this extreme austerity of no eating. We have nice prasadam, we have nice deities. We get to see the deities and fix our eyes on the deities. And some people even get to dress the deities and use their creativity to dress the deities nicely. So much nice service that we get to do. We get to engage our senses, engage our mind, engage our intelligence in the service of Krishna consciousness. So in this way, we get purified gradually. It appears gradually, but it's very fast at the same time. In this just one lifetime, we can make a lot of advancement just by sticking with the process and staying steady in Krishna consciousness. So in this way, we can conquer the enemy of lust that's infiltrated within our mind and intelligence and senses. It's ingrained in our psychophysical nature. But we get to engage in this process because of Srila Prabhupada's mercy, and it uplifts us out of this situation of dissatisfaction, always searching for happiness but never getting it, always thinking there's something I should be doing but it never feels right, going to music concerts or this or that, trying this kind of food, that kind of food, this kind of job, that kind of job, endless ways of trying to become satisfied in the material world, but it never feels like quite what we're looking for. It never hits that complete satisfaction that comes from our relationship with Krishna. So Krishna, Rama, Krishna is the reservoir of all pleasure. So just by actually remembering Krishna, just thinking about Krishna, not like even on like a lower level, not like we have to like become like pure devotees to remember Krishna, just by remembering a little bit about Krishna, like Krishna's plays with the cows, or Krishna has a peacock feather on his head and he wears cool turbans and plays the flute, just by remembering a little bit about Krishna, it brings happiness. We read stories of his exchanges with his devotees, and this chanting, especially then doing kirtan, and really awesome kirtan, brings the satisfaction to the heart that doesn't come from anything else. Our heart becomes satisfied, we become happy. Having nice relationships with Vaishnavas, devotees who are just so giving and selfless and just nice to be around, having a relationship like that is like something you always want. You always need friendship relationships, and you get that with devotees. It's so rewarding. It's something so satisfying to have nice exchanges with the Vaishnavas. That doesn't come from lust, from having a relationship with someone based on sense gratification, based on temporary material happiness. But when everything is situated within the principles of Krishna consciousness for the purpose of serving and reawakening our Krishna consciousness, everything is satisfying. Everything becomes nice. So those are some thoughts on this topic. If anyone has questions, feel free to.
Krishna Prabhu, that was a really good class. You made a lot of good points I would like to mention, but I don't want to mention too many to go too long. But the one thing that I really appreciated you mentioned, that Krishna gave me a click. And you hear some analogies all the time, but sometimes when you hear other people speak, then it clicks. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that we need to sharpen our intelligence by reading Bhagavatam. And I was thinking, naturally, in war, if you don't have a sharpened sword, then you can't kill the enemies. In much the same way, we can't kill our inner demons if we don't sharpen our intelligence by Shrimbatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravanam Kirtana. That's what Krishna said in the Bhagavatam 1:2:17. So I really appreciate it. At that point, I'm going to use that with a lot of devotees now, because that's that clicked for me, so I appreciated that. But my question is related to one point I was meditating on recently, is about advice. When we give advice, Shukacharya, he gave King Yayati advice, don't allow Sarmishta to sleep with you. Yeah. But just in general, the principle of advice, one thing that Shankar Pandit mentioned to me like the other day, is that he says Krishna's Satya Sankalpa, which means when he gives advice or when he thinks of something, it manifests. It's the truth. But when we give advice, it may or may not come true. So a lot of times I've learned in my own Christian consciousness that sometimes if you give someone advice, you know, you may not say it will 100% guarantee work, but sometimes that's the disposition. But we see that, I'll just give a couple of examples. In the material world, blood transfusions. From a logical point of view, a family is able to help their biological family, but blood transfusions, the irony about those is that the most likely person to help you isn't your biological family. Or peanuts. Peanuts are very nutritious. And we may think, yes, everyone, there's nutritious for everyone, but there's something called food allergies. And although it's nutritious for some people, it's deadly for some. So a lot of times when we give people advice, we may think, oh, my advice is more valuable than someone else's advice, and it will work. So my question is that, what should our mentality be in giving advice? Because the tendency is that when our advice doesn't work, people blame us. You know, it didn't come true. And then we make some excuses. But at the same time, people may think we have lack of faith in Krishna. If we say, my advice may or may not work, we may seem unstable. My advice may or may not work. So how does one balance if someone's in that position to give advice? Of course, we all give advice, whether people want to hear it or not. But how does one balance those two mentalities? That I may seem like I have lack of faith in Krishna, and also people may blame us. I'm not sure if you kind of got the question, yeah, both sides, the flip side.
Kind of understand. I think Shukracharya is not so much giving advice, more so giving a warning. Like, if you do this, it's not going to be good. I guess that can be kind of advice, but he's not really telling him to do something. From my experience, like, if we're not sure about giving advice, we probably shouldn't give advice. That's my experience. We shouldn't be so quick to give people advice or advise people or become a mentor as try to step into that position for people, unless you're willing to take on the consequences. Like yesterday, Radha Raman Prabhu was saying that someone a junior to you who's under your advice or giving mentorship, then you take responsibility for their actions. So you're actually, if you tell someone to do something and then they follow you and it's wrong, and the reaction comes to you. So that's like the weight of being a spiritual master. And we hear that the spiritual master takes on the karma of the disciple. It's not like some like mystical like thing. It's just because they're taking responsibility for the person's life. Like, so if someone comes to you and submits themselves to you and you accept them and you assure them that, you know, come with me, we're gonna go back to Godhead. You know, you have to be sure that you're going there and that you're giving the right direction to someone. Otherwise, we shouldn't really give advice to many people. It's like, it's tricky, you know. I found like trying to help people from my limited ability to help people. Unless you have a relationship with that person and there's a strong understanding of where they're at and there's a strong connection of friendship with that person, and there's a big great deal of commitment in that relationship, like as a mentor or a mentee, and you're working together, then it's natural. But outside of that, it's like it's tricky to give advice to people. It's not really recommended, actually, to tell people what to do. It's more so, you can speak in terms of, like, the scriptures, like that. But not some personal guidance is, like, requires that commitment and responsibility. So. questions.
Yeah, I was trying to add something that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is stated it is like love is compared just like a gold, piece of gold, and lust is compared as just like iron, you know, piece of iron. So this is a vast difference between love and lust. That's what.
I have one question. So King Yayati was the disciple of Shukracharya, and as a disciple he would have known that the order of the spiritual master is higher than executing religious duty. So I was wondering what impelled him to disobey the orders of the spiritual master and still follow the religious duty.
One thing that comes to my mind is I'm not sure if he is like his spiritual master per se. I don't know if we heard that. He's not. He's, yeah, I don't think he's necessarily his direct spiritual master. But I think he accepted his requests because he knew it would be good for him to take on his daughter, to marry his daughter, because it would be beneficial for his material desires. But I'm not sure, yeah, I don't think it said that he was his like spiritually initiated disciple. Yeah, so I guess still, I guess, like I said, it's a tricky situation where someone has to be expert. It kind of reminds me of like the situations of King Yudhisthira in the Mahabharata. There's several situations where he gets in where it's like the principles of Dharma are contradicting each other. Where so in this situation, it's like he's being approached to have a son with Sarmishta. So this is, it's against religious principles to not accept that. And he also knows that Shukracharya is requesting these things, maybe not with the purest intention, just out of his own affection for his daughter. He's requesting these things. So that puts him in a tricky situation where he's being requested by a powerful sage to act a certain way according to this sage's material desire of pleasing his daughter. So that's an interesting situation to be in. and he chose to withhold that the principle of religion having a child with Sarmishta.
Thank you.
Some thoughts. Okay, thank you for your participation and your attention in Bhagavatam class. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gantarashima Bhagavatam ki jai.
Sometimes the tension is I want just people to listen. Yeah. To like my
people just don't listen to. And that's where like really powerful. Most people just don't listen to us.
Yeah, exactly. But Hirani Kashyapu, he forced people to listen to him. It's austerity, so they were forced. But that's a good song.